This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Craig McIver, an international human rights lawyer and former High Commissioner for Human Rights at the United Nations.
He tells us that he resigned his position at the United Nations because of their failure and their duty to protect the human rights of the Palestinian people. We'll also hear from the national organizer for the Julian Assange Defense Committee about recent developments in Assange's case, including the CIA and its spying.
And the results of that case may prove helpful to Assange's defenses if he is extradited to the U.S. for trial. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The Israeli air and ground war against 2.3 million Palestinians imprisoned in the Gaza Strip is in its 98th day. Ralph Nader stated on Democracy Now! That the reported 23,000 deaths of Palestinians is vastly understated. He estimated a true count to be around 100,000. Moreover, he projected that because of disease and starvation, 500,000 people in Gaza will likely die this year. International human rights lawyer Craig McIver resigned from the United Nations on October 28. He had worked for the United Nations for more than three decades and was the director of its human rights agency in New York City. In his resignation letter, he wrote that the UN had failed in its duty to protect Palestinians. McIver accused the U.S. and the U.K. and much of Europe of being, quote, wholly complicit in the horrific assault, close quote, in Gaza. Last week, South Africa filed a lawsuit against the government of Israel in the International Court of Justice for the crime of genocide. The ICJ is the court of the United Nations. John Kirby, a spokesperson for the United States, called the lawsuit, quote, counterproductive without any basis in fact whatsoever, close quote. When we speak with Craig McIver, our guest today, we'll ask him about the, quote, basis in fact, close quote, for the lawsuit and much more. Attorney McIver graduated from the University of Buffalo Law School and has lived in the Gaza Strip. Craig McIver, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Please tell us something about your background. We understand you're a second-generation Lebanese-American, born in Buffalo, youngest of six kids. Graduate of University of Buffalo Law School. Tell us about yourself, please.
Well, I think you just told the whole story. I grew up in a working class family in Western New York, in Niagara Falls, in an era when the city was rapidly deindustrializing. It was economically depressed. It was environmentally degraded. It was racially divided. It was a good incubator, a good education about what human rights are supposed to be all about. And then, you know, at the end of the 70s, the early 80s, I moved to Buffalo to continue that education together with a formal education where I studied political science and then later law at the University of Buffalo School of Law. And throughout the 1980s, I was very active in the international human rights movement, and in particular in protesting against and organizing against what the U.S. government was supporting in terms of death squads in Central America, apartheid in South Africa, oppression in Palestine. You name it. That too was a dark era for human rights and a very negative era for the role of the United States government. And that's very much how I got connected with the UN, because later during my law school education, I did some work with the United Nations. That ultimately, after a brief stint as a lawyer in a firm, led to my taking up my job in the United Nations Human Rights Office, where I spent about 32 years working on human rights questions all around the world in solidarity with human rights movements in Africa and Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, and Latin America, and so on. And that continued until I left my job at the end of October of this past year.
Craig, remind us why you took the job at the United Nations in the first place, what it was like when you started there, and if it's changed, how has it changed? And perhaps most important, tell us, what were the circumstances surrounding your decision to, well, resign your important United Nations position recently?
Well, you know, I discovered the UN during my work as a human rights advocate in the 1980s. And It struck me immediately that, of course, there were very principled positions being taken by movements and civil society organizations and people on the streets who were fighting for human rights. But it was impossible in those days to find official institutions in the United States government or in the West that were taking pro-human rights positions on, as far as I could see, anything domestically in the United States or in international affairs. And in the middle of all of my engagement in human rights issues in the 1980s, I happened across this thing called the United Nations, in which I discovered that there was this official institution that was taking the same position that we were on a whole range of human rights issues. You know, it was opposing apartheid in South Africa when the U.S. government, for example, was supporting apartheid in South Africa. It was supporting human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories when the U.S. government and Western governments were opposing human rights in the occupied territories. It was speaking out on the violations that were happening in Latin America. So I was very much intrigued by that, got to know the U.N., did an international legal internship there in the 1980s as well. And I discovered that, you know, the U.N. is founded on a set of principles that are very much aligned with my own ideas of human rights and peace and equality. That was the beginning of a very, very long relationship. And I still believe in the idea of the United Nations, you know, those principles that are articulated by the UN Charter, by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and with all of those people who work in the UN because they hate human rights abuses, they hate inequality, they hate war and violence, and they hate poverty. I mean, that there's a whole legion of people who are working there because they genuinely believe in those principles. But over time, I saw that what was happening in the United Nations was it was increasingly compromising its principles for the sake of political expediency. And in matters of human rights, that is a very, very serious breach. And indeed, in this past year, when I decided to leave the UN, it was precisely because I had decided that that breach had grown so wide that it was interfering with the principle of performance of the duties of the UN. That started for me really in the late winter and early spring, when there were a series of gross violations of human rights being perpetrated against Palestinians in the West Bank, including settler pogroms in villages like Hawara and ethnic cleansing of villages and attacks and arrests by Israeli forces of Palestinian civilians. And of course, I was speaking out publicly on those violations, as I had, by the way, on human rights violations in countries all across the world for more than three decades. And I saw a very trepidatious response coming out of the political offices of the UN that had grown increasingly afraid to speak out frankly on Israeli human rights violations for fear of the blowback that they would get from powerful Western states like the United States and the United Kingdom, but also from Israel lobby groups that make your life a living hell when you dare to speak out about Israeli human rights violations. And I was willing to have that discussion and to keep pressing counterparts in the UN to raise their voices and to not defer to power and to not defer to these smear campaigns. But then I was silenced. I was instructed not to make any public statements on Palestine that had not already been made by the Secretary General or the High Commissioner of Human Rights. That's the first time that had ever happened to me in my entire career. And interestingly, I was not given those instructions with regard to any other situation outside of Israel and Palestine. And so I determined at that moment that if I would force myself to function under those conditions, I would be less effective in advocating for human rights inside the UN than I would outside. And so I indicated then my intention to leave. And of course, in the coming months, the situation on the ground became much worse, and certainly in October, with what I warned in October was an unfolding genocide. And so that's when I penned a letter that has now gone viral to the High Commissioner for Human Rights, setting out what I thought were the missteps of the UN with regard to Israel and Palestine through the years. The warning that Israel was, that the genocide was unfolding there, and then making some suggestions on how the organization could change course in a way that was more consistent with the principles that it articulates in its charter and its human rights instruments, and then left in the end of October on that basis.
Craig, you lived for a time in Gaza. Please tell us about what it was like to live in Gaza and what was done to the Palestinians living there right from 1948, when Israel was established, up until 1967, and then again up to the time of the attack on October 7.
Yeah, I mean, I did my first mission to the occupied Palestinian territories in the late 1980s during the first Intifada. And what struck me immediately there was, first of all, the remarkable disconnect between the realities on the ground on the one hand and what is projected in U.S. corporate media on the other hand. I mean, I think it's not surprising that so many Americans are very, very ignorant of realities in Palestine and the atrocities being perpetrated there, and the fact that they are effectively supported by the United States, by United States tax dollars and by the United States government. And the thing that hit me very strongly there was, you know, I was investigating human rights violations and atrocities there. And at every site where a violation took place, there were literally the words stamped "Made in USA." It was U.S. weaponry. It was U.S. gas canisters. It was U.S. citizens speaking with New York accents who were the soldiers who were perpetrating some of the atrocities. And so the responsibility of the United States for much of the suffering there became readily obvious. The other thing that came obvious very quickly was the racist nature of the violence perpetrated on Palestinians, that Palestinians are a designated group in Israel and in the occupied territories who do not have the rights that flow to other people inside of Israel, and that distinction is made entirely on the basis of ethnicity. It's not on the basis of religion, because Israel is not a religious state, and because Palestinians are both Muslims and Christians. And by the way, there are Palestinian Jews as well, little known fact in this country. And they are targeted in ways and identified in ways that are just purely racist, as is always the case in every settler colonial project, that in order to take the land and to replace one people with another people, you have to diminish the humanity of the indigenous people who were there. And I also was amazed by the incredible dignity and resilience of people who were being subjected, Palestinians, to daily atrocities and indignities of every kind, dominated not just by Israeli forces, but by Israeli settlers, humiliated in every conceivable way. And yet they remained steadfast and dignified and warm and hospitable, and they still laughed and they still loved and they still lived on, much to the chagrin of those who wanted to ethnically purge all of that territory. And then I returned as the UN's senior human rights advisor in 1996 and spent 2 years living in Gaza, traveling around the territories on behalf of the UN, and seeing a continuation. Only there, what I learned was that what was known as the Oslo process and this amorphous political formulation that promised someday there would be a two-state solution, the quartet, all of these things that were happening, the two-state solution, all of these things that were happening at the time and were framing the situation, had become a smokescreen, a disingenuous promise, and a smokescreen behind which what we were seeing was increasing dispossession, persecution, apartheid, gross violations of human rights, and a disappearing of Palestinian life inside the occupied territories, as it had been largely disappeared inside the Green Line in Israel before that. I thought the biggest threat at that time was that the United Nations, the international community, they had shifted away from a focus in Palestine on international law, international human rights, equality, decolonization, all of those things for which the organization was established, and instead to a kind of deference to the parties. So this switch to deference to the parties instead of deference to international law created a problematic situation, because deference to the parties, when you have a situation of occupier and occupied, oppressor and oppressed, powerful state, powerful military, and an occupied population, meant deference to Israel. And I think it was very much designed in that way. You know, that shift into the rhetoric of Oslo ended in large measure the UN's focus on international law and international human rights in looking for solutions. And it ended a focus on the root causes of the conflict, which you weren't allowed to talk about suddenly, right? So you can't talk about settler colonialism, and apartheid and occupation, racism and persecution, settlements, dispossession. All of that was supposed to be deferred. And instead, we're going to be talking about an impossible now promise of a two-state solution. And that shift became very clear when I was working there under the Oslo process in those years in the 1990s. And of course, things have continued to spiral downward to the point where we now have seen an open case of genocide.
My goodness, Craig, we read much of this in the paper, but I would like your account, please, for our listeners, to tell us what are the facts on the ground now today in Gaza since October. How much of the infrastructure has, in fact, been destroyed? Are any hospitals functioning? What about schools? How are the people finding shelter? What about disease, malnutrition, and the like? And, of course, how many have already died?
The situation in Gaza, even before October, was an extreme situation, recognized as such by every international institution and humanitarian actor. Gaza is has been often called an open-air prison because it represents 2.3 million civilians who have been in a cage for 17 years, and before that were already restricted inside of Gaza. And the people in Gaza are mostly refugees. They are mostly children. They are mostly poor, and they are mostly food insecure before October. And they have been subjected every couple of years to periodic military attacks by Israel, which conducts these operations like shooting fish in a barrel and causes massive destruction. Since October, we've seen what has been described as record-setting of destruction. I mean, since October, we have seen the largest concentration of bombing of a densely populated civilian area that has been recorded in the modern era. We have seen the largest number of journalists targeted that have ever been recorded. We've seen the largest number of UN staff murdered that has ever been recorded. We have seen tens of thousands. We are probably close to more than 30,000 now, but we've got counted casualties. About 25,000 now, again, overwhelmingly women, children, and civilian men who have been killed. We've got tens of thousands more who are terribly injured and dying slowly of their wounds. There are no fully functioning hospitals yet left because hospitals have been subjected to Israeli attacks, as every part of civilian infrastructure has been attacked in this assault. Hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, refugee camps, UN installations, humanitarian installations, bakeries, cemeteries, courthouses, the entire structure of life has been intentionally attacked and largely destroyed. Two-thirds of Gaza is destroyed at this moment. And the bombing continues. So they've been moving very systematically from north to south, and now the bombing continues in the south, destroying what's left to sustain civilian life in that country. And in the meantime, you have, because people don't have medical care, food, water, electricity, many of the doctors and nurses and specialists and ambulance drivers have been also targeted and killed. You have people who are literally undergoing painful amputations and operations and cesarean sections without any anesthetic and then being subjected to massive infections. You've got starvation actually occurring in the Gaza Strip on the Mediterranean Sea for the first time, and intentionally imposed starvation on this imprisoned civilian population. You've got disease, including infectious disease, spreading far and wide. And you've got thousands of people under the rubble, those who are not dead, dying slow, agonizing, painful deaths for the crime of having been born Palestinian in Gaza. So it is, has been described by many of the senior humanitarian actors as the worst situation they have seen. And these are people who have spent their career relieving this. It has also been described by hundreds of genocide scholars as the clearest case of genocide that we have witnessed, because all of the requirements of the Genocide Convention, including the specific acts and the stated intent, have been met in this case. And of course, there's a court unfolding as we speak in the international case, unfolding as we speak in the International Court of Justice. So Gaza has been described as a graveyard for children, as a hell on earth, and as the worst situation that humanitarian actors have seen in decades and decades and decades. It couldn't be much worse than it is. And the horror of it is that the situation that we're seeing on the ground, including the levels of destruction, the non-distinction between civilians and combatants, the targeting of civilians, the spreading disease and hunger and thirst, has all been promised publicly by senior Israeli officials and then delivered with the genocidal fury that we are witnessing. Remember, these are not people making these statements who are just peripheral actors or just people who are in the public raging about the losses of October 7th. You're talking about genocidal statements of intent made by the prime minister, the president, at least seven senior cabinet ministers, the military leadership, and a host of other important actors here. And then not only making genocidal statements, but carrying it out on the ground with horrific effect.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Craig Muckheiber, who is a former UN diplomat who resigned his position. Craig, tell us about the lawsuit that was brought by the South African government against Israel for the crime of genocide. After all, the court that's hearing it has no enforcement power. What do you think is going to happen?
That's right. This is the International Court of Justice, the world court that sits in The Hague and is the highest level international court, the High Court of the United Nations system. Its decisions are enforceable. Its decisions are binding. But of course, as a court, it doesn't have an enforceability mechanism in its own right. We'll talk about enforceability. But first, what I'd like to say about this, Michael, is, you know, what you're seeing now is this first glimpse of accountability in what has otherwise been 75 years of impunity in the persecution of the Palestinian people. And, you know, that 75 years is very important because 1948 was the year that the Genocide Convention was adopted, was the year that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted. It was the year that apartheid started in South Africa. And it was the year of the Nakba in Palestine, the first genocidal purging of the Palestinian people. 75 years later, you have the country that has survived and struggled against and defeated apartheid, defending another people who are being subjected to apartheid and genocide today, and demanding accountability from a country that, because it has been protected diplomatically and otherwise by the United States and the West, has not been subjected to accountability in its entire history of these violations. That in itself is historically very, very important. And what South Africa is doing is they're situating this case, this charge of genocide against Israel, as a part of a continuum. You know, since Raphael Lemkin, the Polish Jewish jurist who helped develop the concept of genocide in the 1940s, first sketched this out. He said that genocide is a part of a continuum, and so it is in this case. And so the South Africans set out that this is not something that's just happening in a moment or some abuses that are taking place in an armed conflict, but this is part and parcel of 75 years of apartheid, 56 years of belligerent occupation, a 16-year blockade in Gaza, serious violations of human rights law, grave breaches of humanitarian law, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and that Israel's actions that have been happening on the West Bank that are also involving ethnic purges and gross violations of human rights are intrinsically connected to what they're doing in Gaza, that is the context of what's happening here and suggestive of the crime of genocide. But they also have a very strong case, and I've said that this brief, which has been praised by legal scholars all around the world, South Africa's case that has been presented to the court has been praised as one of the most impressive and strong cases that people have seen in international law. But I said that as brilliant as the South African lawyers are and as righteous as the South African cause is, and they deserve all credit for that, this is a case that writes itself, which is very unusual in genocide because the Genocide Convention sets out what's required, identification of a particular group, in this case, Palestinians living in Gaza, certain acts that are prohibited by the convention if they are carried out with the requisite intent of wanting to destroy a group either in whole or in part. So you've got the group identified very clearly in this case. You've got all five of the acts listed in the Genocide Convention: killing, causing serious harm, creating conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of life there. So we know that we've never had a clearer case in history because of the siege of Gaza that has been specifically and explicitly designed in order to punish the civilian population and to limit their development and their healthcare and their food and their housing and their development in every other respect, is a very specific case meeting that. And you even have the prevention of births, as the South African case makes clear, through what's been called reproductive violence and the targeting of hospitals and women's care and water and sanitation, all of those sorts of things. And so all of that are just, those are just facts. There's no way to avoid a finding that those facts have been perpetrated. The whole world is watching this as it happens. So it, the rest of it turns on the requirement of the Genocide Convention to find genocidal intent. And here, what distinguishes this case from every other genocide case in the past is that Israel, which has enjoyed so many years of impunity because of protection from the U.S. and the West, has been publicly declaring genocidal intent on the record over and over again. As I said, the prime minister, the president, cabinet ministers, military leaders, and so on, so that it is not in a position to deny genocidal intent. You'll see in The Hague what they've been trying to argue today is, yes, those the senior leaders who said it, but they didn't mean it. And the other people who said it, they meant it, but they don't have any power. So you should just ignore these statements of genocidal intent. Well, that's not something the court is likely to do, because, again, these things are on the record and they've been absolutely bone-chilling, to the point of having Prime Minister Netanyahu twice publicly in the, with the public and with his troops invoking the biblical story of Amalek, which commands that no one should be spared, everyone and everything should be destroyed, including women, men, children, suckling babies, and livestock. That's the prime minister, the most powerful political figure, who is commanding the actions that are taking place there. There's a database that's been created now that contains more than 500 genocidal statements by officials in Israel, and that number is growing. That only happens when you have a sense of impunity that convinces you absolutely that you will not be held accountable. Of course, what Israel has been doing is it's been making those statements in Hebrew to its own people, while at the insistence of the United Nations, making the United States, I'm sorry, making statements in English to the outside world that we are respecting humanitarian law, we are avoiding civilian casualties, and so on. I don't think that's going to fly. And certainly we, it's not flying in the case that we're seeing before the International Court of Justice. Now, on enforcement, it's true. So what the South Africans are asking for, remember, genocide is a crime of universal jurisdiction. The convention allows any state to bring a case before the International Court of Justice for genocide, and that's why South Africa is doing this on behalf of the Palestinian people. But what's likely to happen here is that South Africa has requested provisional measures. That's like an injunction in domestic law. Immediate provisional measures to stop the attacks on the Palestinians, to stop the siege so that food and medicine and water can get in, to preserve evidence, to allow fact-finding missions in, to report periodically to the court on the implementation of these things. So immediately they will issue these, almost immediately, in a matter of days, they will issue these provisional measures, their decision on these provisional measures. And then the decision on the merits will take likely a couple of years, where South Africa is asking for a finding of genocide. So, of course, you can't wait for the decision on the merits before acting when people are under attack. The convention is on the prevention and punishment of the crime of genocide, and so action is obviously urgent. Now, in both cases, when a decision is issued on the on provisional measures and on the merits, I fully expect that Israel will not comply. And what happens normally then is the case is brought to the Security Council, and the Security Council is supposed to enforce the decision of the court. But as we know, the United States is on the Security Council, and it will use its veto to stop the implementation of the court's decision so that Israel can continue its attacks in Gaza. At that point, what will happen is that countries will then convene in the General Assembly an emergency special session under the so-called Uniting for Peace resolution that allows the General Assembly to take up the case. And there you will see a resolution that will include various measures that can be taken to hold Israel to account. It doesn't have the force of the Security Council, but there's a lot that could be done there. They could set up mechanisms. States could challenge Israel's membership in international organizations. The General Assembly could call for legal action, criminal action. Individual states and states collectively could also take measures, economic measures, political measures, withdrawal of consular relations, withdrawal of diplomatic relations, non-recognition of passports. There could be criminal indictments in third-party courts because this is a crime of universal jurisdiction. It could help to mobilize the International Criminal Court, which has done a horrific job of following up on cases brought against Israel in the past because of the bias of the prosecutor in that court. But I think that public opinion and a decision of the International Court of Justice could help to mobilize them to take the necessary action. And of course, you could have civil society and movements that could activate political action, boycotts, other people measures, in order to hold Israel accountable and to pressure it in the way that South Africa was pressured, that ultimately brought down apartheid in that country. So there's a lot that can be done, even if the U.S. uses its veto in the Security Council. And regardless of what happens here, I think that it is Israel is certainly on trial in that case. But the entire international system, international law, international institutions are also on trial. Because if things can get this bad to the point of genocide and have such a massive failure of international institutions and international law, that will be the end of this 75-year-old experiment with international law. And God only knows what will come next.
Yes. Well, Craig Mulgaver, sorry. I'm sad to say we're out of time, I'm afraid, my friend. So I wonder, can you let our listeners know where they can follow your writings, learn more about what we've been talking about today? Give our listeners some guidance on that before we have to let you go.
Well, I've only freed myself from the shackles of the United Nations for a couple of months now, and I've been very much engaged in this work. You can expect that I will continue to be very active in the international human rights movement. I am on all social media using my own name, at Craig Mulgaver. You can find it there. And I hope to get some of my work posted up elsewhere soon.
Craig, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Thank you for your forceful, powerful, really affecting presentation. We applaud you. We thank you for your good work. We hope to speak with you again. You take it easy.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you both for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On December 19th, a federal court in New York rendered a decision of profound importance. It has to do with claims of illegal actions by the CIA and others, and it was brought by attorneys representing the world-renowned journalist and founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Assange is currently in prison in London awaiting a final ruling in the U.S. government's efforts to extradite him back to the United States and stand trial for violation of the Espionage Act of 1917 for having published documents exposing U.S. war crimes in connection with America's wars in the Middle East. In their lawsuit against the CIA, former CIA head Mike Pompeo and others, Assange's attorneys alleged that the CIA violated the attorneys' constitutional rights by subjecting them to illegal surveillance during their visits with Assange while he was staying in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been granted asylum. While the other claims of the attorneys were dismissed by the court, the CIA was not dismissed from the lawsuit. And so the plaintiffs have won a rare, rare opportunity for the clandestine operations of the CIA, which prides itself on secrecy, to now be subjected to public scrutiny and accountability through discovery actions in connection with the plaintiff's claims. The importance, the significance of this victory against the CIA cannot be overstated. And to help us understand how this victory came to pass, what the alleged abuses of the CIA were that led the judge to deny the attempt of the CIA to be dismissed from the lawsuit, we're very pleased to have as our guest today Vincent DiStefano, the chief organizer for the National Defense Committee for Julian Assange. Mr. DiStefano is a lifelong social justice activist and a founding member of the Southern California Assange Defense Committee, as well as serving on the executive board of the National Defense Committee. He is the past president of the Pasadena Foothills chapter of the ACLU and a board member of the Southern California ACLU. He has worked for decades for Amnesty International. He has been the winner of their Urgent Letter Writer of the Year Award. So, Vince DiStefano, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you very much, Maria.
Vince, perhaps you should first briefly remind our listeners who Julian Assange is, why there is a worldwide movement to end his prosecution by the United States for having published, well, classified U.S. documents. Documents proving this country's war crimes in the course of its wars in the Middle East, and let us know where Assange's legal battle stands today as well.
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me on and give me an opportunity to speak about this subject. For those who may not know Julian Assange or the work he's done with WikiLeaks, it was an organization he formed. I might add, he formed with a great deal of women. Most of the people that were in the original core group of WikiLeaks were women. On October 4th, 2006, his methods at WikiLeaks quite literally changed the very concept of journalism as we know it. He and WikiLeaks staff created a completely anonymous Dropbox for any whistleblower to deposit documents. Documents anonymously. Now, WikiLeaks would then vet them to ensure their accuracy, then redact them thoroughly to ensure no harm to any individuals, organizations come from their publication, then work with media outlets around the world to put them in print for the public to see, to for them to determine the truth on their own using the original documents. I might add that all journalists and all media outlets use this model developed by WikiLeaks today. The documents they published were from many different sources and covered an incredible array of subjects, pretty much all of them making public crimes, failures, breaches of the public trust that those entities wished to keep secret. WikiLeaks made many enemies, as you can imagine, along the way. However, it was not until he released the collateral murder video that the U.S. National Security put him on their crosshairs.
Vince, the lawsuit Jim mentioned in his introduction centers around the time when Julian Assange was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, after he'd been granted asylum by the Ecuadorian government. While he was there, he had some visitors, including his legal counsel, who discussed his legal defenses and strategies about the charges he faced in the U.S. What do they allege happened to them while meeting with Assange that caused them to sue the CIA, former CIA Director Mike Pompeo, the private surveillance company Undercover Global, and others in federal court in New York?
Well, thank you, Maria. That is an absolutely excellent question. This case regards the CIA-sponsored surveillance of four U.S. citizens, civil rights attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, media attorney Deborah Hebrick, and two journalists, John Getz and Charles Glass. That surveillance was executed, as you said, by the Spanish security firm Undercover Global, known as UC, and its director, David Morales, at the behest of and under the guidance of the CIA. The particulars of this case are whether such actions violate the reasonable expectation of privacy provided by the Fourth Amendment. They had four targets of the litigation: the CIA, as you said, its former director, Mike Pompeo, Morales, and UC Global. Now, the plaintiffs believe that the U.S. government had conducted surveillance on them, copied information during visits to Assange and the embassy without their knowledge, thereby violating their Fourth Amendment rights. Now, on December 19th, Judge John G. Caudill delivered a judgment which, in part, granted the U.S. government's motion to dismiss, but denied many of the other parts, the most important parts. However, the main focus for the plaintiffs was whether they had standing to sue the CIA in the first place. That is an incredibly high bar to match. However, they cited ACLU versus Clapper, which involved a challenge to the National Security Agency's bulk telephone metadata collection program, and Cottle accepted that they did. In doing so, he rejected a similar argument made by the government in Clapper that injuries alleged were simply too speculative and generalized, and that the information gathered via surveillance might not necessarily be used against them. In this case, Judge Cottle said, the plaintiffs need not allege, as the government argues, that the government will immediately use their information collected at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The search of the conversation and electronic devices, along with the seizure of the contents of the electronic devices, were unlawful. According to Judge Cottle, the plaintiffs have suffered a concrete and particularized injury fairly traceable to the challenge program and redressable by a favorable ruling. In other words, the case can go forward. Even if it's a small portion, the case will go forward.
Yes, correct, Vinny. And that's very important, isn't it? And we're going to talk about that. We've mentioned already that other defendants, those in fact, except for the CIA, were dismissed from the attorney's lawsuit. And the fact that the CIA, though, was not dismissed from this lawsuit is what I think, and I think you think, and many others, makes this case so profoundly important. I mean, the plaintiffs, Assange's lawyers, are now going to be able to gather documentary evidence. They're going to be able to take depositions under oath, exposing the details of the CIA's alleged wrongdoing. In fact, it's believed that there may be a public trial as early as sometime this year. Therefore, this case presents a rare opportunity for the clandestine operations of the CIA, an agency that's famous, prides itself on its secrecy, to be subjected to public scrutiny and accountability, doesn't it? Talk to us about why this is so important.
Well, you are absolutely right, Jim. This is incredibly important because with this decision, it is now allows, as you said, discovery to move forward that'll put the gross misbehavior of the CIA in the public record and it can be used in Julian's defense. Please remember when we refer to this, in the Pentagon Papers case, it was not that Daniel Ellsberg prevailed in court, but rather the government overstep, exactly like what took place in this case, caused the Justice Department to throw out the case based on government misconduct. The CIA and the NSA have long used the concept of national security to prevent any information they find troubling, regardless of the public interest being exposed, to U.S. citizens. On this one issue, public interested litigants and activists see Judge Cottle's decision as an absolutely epic win. Because now the prospect of the civil trial against the CIA for violations of the U.S. Constitution are no longer unrealistic, not just for Julian, not just for these four defendants, but for everyone. We are, and in fact, the plaintiff's attorney, Richard Roth, one hell of an attorney, said, we are thrilled that the court rejected the CIA's efforts to silence the plaintiffs who merely seek to expose the CIA's attempt to carry out Pompeo's vendetta against WikiLeaks, which is most assuredly was.
And Vince, wasn't it about a year ago that documents were released showing that then President Trump and then CIA Director Pompeo openly discussed the option of murdering Julian Assange to shut him up and send a message to other journalists who might dare do what he did? Talk about this, please.
Oh, yes, Maria. It's hard to believe that the U.S. government and the CIA were so open and clumsy about plotting to kidnap and then assassinate Julian Assange. And I might add, who at the time had not been charged with a crime, let alone convicted. What is even more appalling is that their Keystone Cops plans included a shootout on Embassy Row without concerns for the obvious collateral damage that this plan necessitated. I mean, it was just crazy. However, their plans are far more nefarious, and I'm sad to say successful in one very important way. When Charles Glass visited Julian in Belmarsh Prison recently, not long after seeing him for 6 years, he reports that Julian looked deathly pale. Now, Julian quipped, that's called a prison pale. Now, that's because Julian has not been outdoors, apart from the minutes when the police dragged him into a paddy wagon from the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012, and for 7 years he was locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy. That's more of 11 years without sunlight. However, as horrible as that, it is not what troubles Julian. He sees our current follies regarding the invasion of Ukraine and Gaza and understands that we desperately need now exactly the same kind of scrutiny that WikiLeaks provided the world for more than 16 years. He goes on to regret that WikiLeaks is no longer able to expose war crimes and corruptions they've done so courageously in the past. His imprisonment and U.S. government surveillance and restrictions on WikiLeaks funding are a warning to all potential whistleblowers the fate that awaits them if they follow in Julian's footsteps. Due to his head on a pike, if you'll excuse that expression, so to speak, he also knows that other media outlets and journalists are now very reluctant to fill that vacuum left by the silence of WikiLeaks, which we need so desperately now.
This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall, interviewing Vincent DiStefano, the chief organizer for the Julian Assange Defense Committee. Vince, doesn't the shameful fact that a president of the United States and a CIA director were willing to do that, to go to such lengths to silence Julian Assange, even willing to kidnap and kill him, doesn't that demonstrate just how important it is, how important Julian Assange is, and how important it therefore is for us, listeners and the people of this country, to speak out before it's too late to save Julian Assange? Isn't it the case that no democracy has really been able to survive very long without a free and courageous press, a press willing to let all the facts, all the truth on matters as important as how a nation is conducting its wars, be made available to the people living in that democracy? It's certainly no secret that here in the United States, our level of democracy has been greatly diminished anyway over the recent years. So talk to us about why it is so important to defend press freedom in America and why that means it's so damned important to defend Julian Assange.
Jim, all I can say is you're 100% on this. I will quote Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers. He said, "The basis of our government being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." He went on to say that the best defense and cornerstone of democracy rests in the foundation of an informed and educated electorate. That's exactly what Julian and WikiLeaks work so tirelessly and unselfishly to do for all of us, to share the truth which to be hidden. To quote Jaslyn Radick, national security and human rights attorney, "How we treat Julian is a harbinger of how we will treat journalists, sources, activists, and dissidents in the future. If Julian and WikiLeaks are criminally prosecuted, the New York Times and its reporters are equally vulnerable." That is what the Obama administration referred to as the New York Times problem when they refused to prosecute Julian the way that the Trump administration did and now the Biden administration carrying through. One of the greatest minds of the 20th century, Albert Einstein, said that the strength of the Constitution lies entirely in the determination of each citizen to defend it. Only if every single citizen feels duty-bound to share his defense are the constitutional rights secure. Therefore, I tell your listeners, if you care about democracy, you should care what happens to Julian Assange. Let me be clear here. This is not a left or right issue, not a Republican or Democratic issue. It is something that all of us who care about our country and the liberty we all cherish must fight to protect. It is the First Amendment and your right to know what is being done in your names with your tax dollars that is on trial in England, and quite frankly, not Julian. If you care about those things for you and all future generations, please join us in the fight to free Julian Assange.
So, Vince, how can listeners go on record as wanting the U.S. to end its prosecution of Julian Assange? What can we all do to save Assange and press freedom in America?
Well, thank you for that question. I was waiting for that. Please, first and foremost, go to the action page at AssangeDefense.org and write and call over your elected officials, and do so every single day that Julian remains in their crosshairs, and respectfully demand that the case be dropped once and for all. Each of our elected officials, when they took office, swore an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic, and calling for an immediate halt to this highly unconstitutional case is the best way for them to defend our right to know and to preserve our precious civil liberties and constitutional rights. I might also add that there is a resolution, H.R. 934, in the House. It currently has six signatories, which is calling for this case to be dropped. In addition to calling and asking for the extradition to be dropped, call your congressman and tell them to become co-signers on this. There is no reason for them not to.
Just so our listeners understand, it's not just us that think this matter is so critically important. There's a whole worldwide movement, hasn't it, grown up to defend Julian Assange. And all over this country, there are groups like there are in L.A. and Chicago and New York and where have you, defending and working to defend Julian. There's a National Defense Committee that you work for. We have some rather prestigious heads of that, don't we? And there's been amazing actions in England that I know you've been a part of. So talk to us so that our listeners get a sense of how the rest of the world certainly understands just how important this is.
Well, there's good news and bad news on that, Jim, and that's an excellent question. Around the world, in England, in Australia, in London, I work very closely with all the organizations that are coordinating to see Julian free because they realize that the precedent set by this case will not just end press freedom here in the United States, but allow any nation anywhere in the world that has someone printing truthful information they find distasteful, and they can snatch them away the same way the United States has done for Julian. So we work with Don't Extradite Assange. For those listeners that may be outside the U.S., there is Assange Defense Australia. There are organizations in Latin America. And unfortunately, although we had visits from the Australian parliamentarians. There were 16 of them came over to the United States, but there were 70 of them. These are people who agree about nothing. They came together to call for this extradition to be dropped. In Britain, 60 parliamentarians did likewise. So far in the United States, we've got 16 congressmen who've called for this. Now, this is the birthplace of press freedom, the United States. That's why it's incumbent upon all the people that care about that to care about Julian. So we have a lot of activists all across the country. We need more of them. We need more people to be involved in this because it is so, so dangerous for us to lose. Once we lose our press freedom, we lose the very foundation of our democracy.
I'm thinking, too, about the fact that he died recently, of course, but one of the heads of the organization, of course, was Dan Ellsberg himself, who was willing basically to go to jail again if need be on behalf of Assange. That's how strongly he felt about it. My goodness, I remember you yourself, Vinny, were in England, in London, where he's being held in this awful prison, at where an organization of so many thousands of people came together. I think you surrounded the entire parliament or something?
Across the Thames and around, there was something like 5,000 to 10,000 people there. By the way, I might also add that the only news outlet that was there to cover this incredible activity was Fox News. No CNN, no BBC, no one was there because you got to remember that the major news organizations are owned by five corporations. They don't really fear about this because they're going to continue to print what is the current line of the government. However, organizations like KPFK, the Pacifica Network, Consortium News, Substack, all of those people are definitely in the crosshairs with Julian. It was incredible to be there with all those speaking out. When we've had events here in the United States, the turnout was very low. And of course, now with the situation in Gaza, the situation in Ukraine, it's very, very difficult to put focus on this as it was to put focus on closing Guantanamo. But it is of epic importance that we do it because the foundation of everything we have in our system of governance is based on a free and adversarial press. That's what Pacifica is. That's not what the New York Times is. That is not what CNN is.
And before I let you go, remind people how they can be in touch with the National Defense Committee website. What is that address?
That's AssangeDefense.org, and you can go to the action page there. You could write to the president, Anthony Blinken, and most importantly, Merrick Garland. But again, you can also send letters to your congressmen and to your senators. They need to step up to the plate. They need to ensure that we have a democracy that will survive more than by the time they put Julian in prison, because once he goes to prison, our First Amendment rights go with him.
Oh, dear. Yes. Well, Vinny DiStefano, I thank you so very much for the work that you're doing on behalf of Freedom of the Press, Julian Assange, and of course, for joining us today here on Law and Disorder.
I thank you and Maria so very much for having me. I really cannot tell you how much I appreciate this. It is so important. So thank you both very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.